Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harrah's.
You got to
know. Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Jackpot.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Welcome to the show. I am Paul Harrah's here in St. Louis, while my partner Dennis Phillips is off in Europe playing in the World Series of Poker Europe. Today we've got a special show for you that I recorded with Bart Hansen and David Tuckman, a couple of poker broadcasters and pros who you may know from watching this summer's coverage of the main event on ESPN3 and also ESPN2. Dave and Bart also are co-hosts of Live at the Bike, the streaming coverage of a live cash game that goes on at the Bicycle Casino out in Las Vegas. Bart also does the Deuce Plays podcast for Deuces Cracked and used to be on Poker Road. They sat down with me in the Harrah's Poker Room, and we started off first talking about how long Live at the Bike has been on the air.
It started back in 2005. In the early parts of 2005, it started and went for a couple of years. And then it stopped for a while. It was in hiatus. But it's recently come back in January of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
2011?
2011.
2011.
Yeah, 2011.
Yeah.
And what games are usually played there, Bart?
Well, it's normally 5-10. Uncapped, no limit, but we've been putting down 3-5, and sometimes we put down bigger games too. Sometimes we'll put 10-25 down, and we'll play 25-50. And we were just talking before we were recording about how rare it is actually to get a straight no limit game these days that goes above 10-20, because I play mostly over at Commerce, and they used to always have 20-40 no limit there. They never have it now. The game doesn't go at all, and the 10-20 games are really, really hit or miss. So, you know, it's funny, in this era of calling different things a Ponzi scheme, like full tilt, poker is almost like a pyramid scheme in the sense that if you have good players and, you know, years and years go by and there isn't a new influx of money, especially when we hit like a recession,
yep,
the games are kind of going to dry up, you know, and I think we kind of see that now. And I think it has to do with the recession in the last 2-3 years, is that if people aren't coming in and still dumping off money, they used to. 3-4 years ago, you'd always have a guy come in and, you know, be an action player. You don't see that anymore.
No, you're
and,
right.
And with the rakes, it's going to be more and more difficult to consistently turn a profit, especially in straight no limit when people get better.
Well, we've found here in St. Louis that you got to grow the games from the bottom up. And sometimes the good players want to play bigger. The 2-5 players want to play 5-10. The 5-10 players want to play 10-20 or 10 1/4. The PLO players want to play a 5-10 uncapped game and put, you know, $3,000 on a table or more. And pretty soon you're getting only good players playing against good players, and you're not growing the new players who have to come into a game and bring the money to the table.
Well, I mean, it's logical in the sense that, you know, the bad players, a bad player either goes broke, is either filthy rich, or learns how to play.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of three things, and you see all the time. I mean, I don't know if it's so much recession. I don't know if it's the economy, because a lot of the guys that were, like, you know, the big fish that were the wealthy guys that were playing before, you know, they still have a lot of money, and they're still doing pretty well. It's just a matter of, you know, if you're a fish for 5 years, generally you learn how to play a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so the easy money's not quite there, and obviously the good players are still around. Sometimes you have those players that play 1-2 or even smaller. They get enticed by the big pots, and they play one, you know, they go, oh, I'll take a shot. And they don't realize that, you know, maybe you shouldn't take 1/3 of your bankroll or one, you know, 1/2 of your bankroll into a bigger game. You know, you end up losing that, and then, you know, we don't hear from that player once, you know, like for another 6 months or another 6 years.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the guys, though. I mean, yeah, the super rich are still rich, but I think it's the guys, especially in the games that I play, which is 5-10 and 10-20, no limit. It's the guys that own their own business that are, you know, small to medium wealthy, guys that maybe are used to, you know, that they could drop 10-20 grand in a month, and you would see like dozens of those guys come in. Those are the guys that you don't see quite anymore.
Yeah, we used
come
to have,
through.
We had a guy on Live at the Bike back in 05 and 06, a guy called Alan, and we called him That's Alan.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a guy who literally played every hand. He was a good guy, and I mean, he'd go on a heater and he'd win $60,000. And, you know, then, you know, variance would hit, and you know, he'd go back to the norm, and he'd end up down 100,000. And in the end of the day, he was definitely a losing player.
Yep.
You know, I don't know exactly what he made, but he definitely made well over six figures.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a guy who had no problem, you know, losing $30,000 or $40,000 in a year.
Yep.
And we have not seen this guy in 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes to show, again, I think it's the small business owner. Maybe that some of their stuff has dried up. But when you were talking about kicking the game up, it's really an interesting dynamic in L.A. because L.A. is not big on PLO like it is here in the Midwest, but it's a new game out there. At Commerce, they're starting to spread it on a regular basis at either 10-20 or 20-40, which is just huge.
Huge.
But there's a money grab going on. They don't. What the regulars that are decent at PLO don't realize, and I can't believe I can't believe they haven't figured this out, is that they'll start the game at 10-20. You know, a couple guys will come over because they use the same chips as 10-20 No Limit, even though the game's like three times the size. A couple guys come over that have never played the game. And then all of a sudden, when they see a couple of people that they don't know, they all of a sudden want to kick it up. And no one is even bankrolled to play 20-40 PLO. I mean, people don't keep that amount of cash around on them. So I think that PLO at those higher stakes is really unsustainable, because I had a guy come on my podcast and say that, you know, recreational players, they don't like two things. They don't like suckouts, and they don't like tough decisions. And that's what PLO is. The entire thing is suckouts and tough decisions.
Right.
And the game is just so huge that I just don't know if the game's going to last there. And I think that the pros are going about it the wrong way. And they do it in other games, too, like Limit Hold'em. There used to always be 100, 200 Limit Hold'em in game at Commerce. They killed some of the guys that were big fish that contributed that game, because all of a sudden, you know, maybe a year ago, these guys would come in, they'd be like, let's kick it up to 4-8. So now, instead of the guy losing like 20, 30 a month, all of a sudden he lost 200,000 one month, and that was it. He couldn't hide it, or he was like, wait a minute, can't lose 200,000 in a month.
Right.
I'm good losing 20, 30,000.
200,000 might have been what he was going to lose in a year. Now he's lost it in a month, and he
yeah.
goes, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just kind of greediness, and it's just,
well,
you know.
I think it's a big mistake by a lot of the regulars and a lot of professional, quote-unquote professional poker players, who either A, don't make the game entertaining, they don't make the game inviting, or at the same time, they try to kick it up. We were playing 1025 at the bike during the Legends. This was, you know, this is a little while back. And there were a couple of fish in the game, and the game was good, you know. But nobody was properly rolled to kick it up any higher, you know. We all had, say, $4,000 or $5,000 in front of us.
Yep.
And then one of the regulars, one of the professionals, said, hey, let's make this a 2550 game. But I knew none of the fish in the game were going to put more money on the table.
Right.
I'm going, well, first of all, as a professional, why would you want to play it? Why would you want to play 70 big blinds deep when you can play at 200 big blinds deep?
Mm-hmm.
I go, that's just going to give them a bigger. In generally, I mean, it's going to give them. It's going to make the game a little bit more high variance.
Yep.
You know, and give them a little bit more of an edge, and also make everybody a little bit more uncomfortable in terms of the players who don't normally play there.
Right.
Just kind of surprising. The interesting thing about Live at the Bike, getting back to that, is, you know, we're getting a new RFID table, which is going to make it possible for us to, you know, spread PLO, spread all the four-card games as well as Hold'em.
Now, explain what an RFID table is.
You know, I'll be honest. I don't know exactly what it is when it comes to technology. I don't really know anything. All I do know is that our cards and the table are kind of going to be in sync.
And the chips.
The chips are not going to be, actually.
Well, they've talked about adding RFID tables to, like, tournament streaming. We don't have plans, but right now people don't realize that even when we did ESPN stuff, it's literally someone's looking at the whole card cameras. There's a software program, and they're manually clicking, you know, four of clubs, four of diamonds. With this, you won't need someone to assign the cards to the graphic software. It'll just automatically appear. That's why we'll be able to do PLO, because you couldn't do PLO live with a guy doing it manually, covering the whole table. You wouldn't have time to see all four cards.
Pardon me while I type in 36 cards.
Right.
That's basically it. And, you know, so we are getting that, which will make the cards a little bit easier. Then the person that was normally, we have this guy named Cardboy Ronnie, who all of our fans affectionately known as Cardboy Ronnie. He's been putting the cards in for the last 6 years. He will now be out there doing the chips. So we'll get the pot size right. We'll get how many chips each player has. Because right now it's, you know, Bart and I have been doing it for a while, so we're fairly good at guesstimating.
Yeah.
But a lot of times it's just an estimate.
Do you have to go down there every once in a while and tell the players, stacks of 20. No sloppy stacks. You're screwing it up
for us. We don't really, you know what, though, in a cash game it's not so important. Sometimes when we stream these tournaments, that becomes critical, because you need to know the stack sizes. But in a cash game, we just eye it. And it's funny to have people come in, because people that are used to doing other broadcasts where everything's in front of them, And they're like, how do you guys do this? You know what I mean? We've been doing it for so long. It's an, you know, it's live, it's raw, and it's an approximation.
Yeah, I mean, and cash games as well, obviously. Yeah. Okay, so he's either 200 big blinds deep or he's 250 big blinds deep. The decision's still pretty much the same.
Right.
That being said, though, it'll be helpful for us to know exactly how many chips somebody has and you know, how many he's left behind and so forth, so we can, you know, we can properly kind of, you know, analyze the bet sizing.
Let's talk a little bit about the controversy that has, I guess, been amplified this year by other people starting to stream. For instance, the WSOP this summer, which you were involved in broadcasting, was streaming a lot of final tables on WSOP 3 and on ESPN 2 and 3 and on ESPN. They did some of the stuff for the main event. WPT is doing it now. Tony Dunst is doing those for their final tables. EPT has done them as well. Live at the Bike has been around for a long time. There are players who look at this and go, wait a second, if it's on a 10-minute delay, you guys do yours on 10, right?
It depends. When we did Live at the Bike is generally a 15-minute delay.
Uh-huh.
You know, when we do the bigger tournaments, a lot of times we'll do an hour delay or a 30-minute delay.
And at the series, it was, what, 30?
At the series delay, if it was on ESPN 3, it was a 30-minute delay. If it was on ESPN, it was... No, I'm sorry. If it was on ESPN 3 with no hold
10
cards.
Ten minutes.
It was no delay. It was live. And if it was on ESPN 2 or if it was on ESPN 3 with hold cards,
right,
then we did a 30-minute delay.
Yeah. It's with the hold cards that some people have complained that you're giving away too much of my game here to other guys who are at the table. With technology, with Twitter, with guys who can watch it at home and feed information to their friends who are playing, a guy steps away from the table because he's got a text coming in from a friend. Hey, Bart had queens in that hand. You made a good laydown. Or Bart had queen three in that hand. You made a horrible laydown. He bluffed you. All that sort of stuff. They complain that there's too much information. What do you guys who are in the streaming business say to those complainers?
You know, this is such a polarizing argument because it's funny. I mean, I've talked with some really, really intelligent people that know poker well who are so adamant about that this is, oh, this is terrible for poker. It's the worst thing ever. And to me, it's where poker is going. The pros so far outweigh the cons that it's not even close. And to me, I mean, the successful poker players all adjust and adapt. The game is all about adjusting and adapting to your opponents, to the situation, to whatever may be going on. Well, if I'm playing in a poker game and I just bluffed Bart, but he doesn't know about it, but I think maybe, you know, I'm going to adjust to, okay, what just happened to it in a particular hand. Well, the same way happens where if I bluffed Bart or if I played a certain hand a certain way, I took a certain line playing a particular hand, and I know that Bart might know this an hour later. Well, Bart also knows that I know that he knows this. And you just take it level after level.
Yeah.
So I can choose to adapt and adjust my play based on the fact that Bart now knows this.
Yep.
The same way I would if I were playing in a game and I got called down really late and I had to show down a bluff. Well, I now know that the rest of the players at the table, their image of me might change. And I have to change my game. I don't see why it's such a big deal to do that. To use the analogy for sports, you know, in this day and age, where there's ridiculous amount of technology in the NFL, I can immediately and there's computer graphics and computer simulations and so forth. Where if I'm playing against the New England Patriots, for example, and Bill Belichick, I know that on third down and one or third down and two, he does this 81% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he also knows that he does this 81% of the time. He knows I know this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just mind games, and it's one player trying to outthink the other one in a sport or in a game that is anything but static.
And going along with that, too, like in an NFL game, you can make real-time adjustments, too, because they're getting still photography of the coverages, you know, in the last series. They
right.
see exactly the coverages. They see their blitz packages, stuff like that. So they make the adjustments. I think this argument's going to be moot pretty quickly. This is just the same argument that they made like back in 2002.
Think about
when
Eric
they
Seidel.
First started doing hold cards back then on a delay. Yeah. I just think that like within a year when everybody's doing it, I don't think we're going to even talk about it anymore because it's just all about adjustments.
I asked Vince Van Patten about this because you know they're in their 10th season of doing this, and he said when we started the WPT, Daniel Negreanu and Jennifer Harmon and some of the other pros hated the idea of having their hands shown on television with the hold card cam. everybody would now agree it's the greatest thing to happen to poker.
It publicized, well, it made it watchable.
It made it watchable. It made it something that you could be a part of instead of going, huh, I wonder what this guy has. I wonder what this guy has.
And this actually makes, I think this makes tournament poker even more watchable, because I think that it's pretty much a consensus that cash game poker is a lot more entertaining on TV, maybe outside of the World Series Poker main event, than tournament poker. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the ratings for the WPT and stuff, who really wants to watch a WPT or something else where, you know, it's a final table, you're seeing it edited, and you're seeing it 8 months later. I have no interest in that.
Actually,
now,
their ratings were up last year, about 37%.
Okay, well, I mean, compare it to 5 years ago, though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But then if you bring it in live, though, where there's actually a sporting feel to it where you don't know the outcome.
Right.
Then I think that it's going to bring more.
Yeah, if you watch a WPT telecast and it's 5 minutes till the end of the hour and one guy moves all in and the other guy calls, you pretty much know this is the end of the tournament right here.
Yeah. If it's fit into the hour, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky enough where I've done a lot of European Poker Tour webcasts where we don't show whole cards at all. And those have been, it's been a lot of fun, and I've worked on those for a while. It was great. You know, I've worked on Live at the Bike where we see whole cards.
Mm-hmm.
And then this past summer, you know, I worked in the World Series of Poker. I was fortunate enough to work with Olivier Bousquet. I worked with Brandon Adams. And it was a lot of fun. I will say, one of the things that I really enjoy, which I think is the best way to do it, is the way we did it at the World Series of Poker this summer, where we don't show you the whole cards until the hand is over. Because then the people at home can really play along. Or sometimes maybe we show one card, or maybe we show one person's cards and not the other person's cards.
Mm-hmm.
And I can put my color guy, I can put my analyst on the spot and go, okay, what does he have? What are you putting him on? Olivier was ridiculously accurate. It was so impressive. But it wasn't surprising. A good poker player should be able to put his opponents on hands. That being said, I just think, to me, that was really, really fun, because it's almost as if when you see the whole cards from the start, you can lose some of the drama. Not showing whole cards at all is ridiculously unsatisfying.
Yep.
Because you never know. But this way, I think it's kind of a little bit of both, where it's the player at home can really watch, can learn, and can play along. It's one of those things, as if you were watching a football game. Again, it's. I don't want to know that I'm fourth down and one, he's going to do a play action fake to the tight end. But I can guess at home. I go, oh, what would you call here?
Mm-hmm.
What is he going to call? What do you think? What defense would you play against this offense
right
now? And you can kind of play along a little bit as a coach. And I think the same way as a poker player, you can do that at home with the way we did it this summer at the World Series.
I'm glad you mentioned Olivier, because I thought he was the most impressive of the pros who sat in the booth for the live broadcasting. You had him and Brandon Adams.
I had Phil Gordon as well, yeah.
And I think Lon McCarron had Antonio Sfondiari at a time, and I thought Antonio was terrific, too. Mm. And Phil Hellmuth was Phil Hellmuth.
Very politically correct there. I like that.
Well, believe me, we make enough fun of Phil. He earned a lot more respect from us this summer with the second-place finishes, and we actually had him on the show and talked to him about all those things. But he was Phil. He is Phil at all times. But Olivier really, really impressed me. Had he ever done that before?
No, he actually hasn't. The thing that really impressed me about Olivier was obviously his performance on the air was great. And by the way, Bart actually did as well. Bart worked with Lon during the 25K heads up.
Oh.
50K Players Championship.
50K Players Championship. Oh, but you took it to the fruition, didn't you?
Yeah, to the end. Yeah.
They did it at the end on the live webcast. It was interesting because Bart and I thought we were going to work together, but it seemed like they wanted to keep us separate,
mm-hmm.
and which was fine, actually.
Uh-huh.
We hang out enough together. But, yeah, Olivier was great, getting back to him. He was great, and the thing that impressed me the most about him was how eager he was to learn. We worked together once, then we went out, we had lunch, we went up to a suite with his manager, and we watched some footage. We talked poker for hours. We talked about what works and what doesn't work. We watched our broadcast together. And, you know, so it was one of those things where I could work on my craft, he could work on his craft, and we could work on the chemistry together. I really, really enjoyed working with him, and how eager he was to learn was what impressed me the most.
Yeah, very impressive for a rookie. As a veteran broadcaster, I could say, this guy really impressed me, and you were feeding him the right stuff, and you worked together very well.
He made my job so easy.
Yeah. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Paul Harris sitting in Harris Poker Room in St. Louis while Dennis Phillips is over playing poker professionally in Europe. I'm sitting here with David Tuckman and Bart Hansen, the co-hosts of Live at the Bike, who have done so many other things and also play in tournaments and in cash games as well. Let's talk about the big story of the last few weeks, and that, of course, is the Department of Justice stepping things up in the online poker war. Black Friday wasn't enough. Now they've come out, and Parit Bharara, who's the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, called Full Tilt Poker not a poker company, but a global Ponzi scheme. And he named Howard Lederer and Chris Ferguson and Rafe First as guys who they're going after, and they're going after their property and trying to seize their assets as well. Give me your takes on this. Bart, you first.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. You know, I always said, you know, a couple weeks before Black Friday, I had this thing happen to me with Full Tilt where I hadn't played on there in literally a year and a half. And this was like April 1st. I got a $600 charge on my account. And I said, what is this? I haven't played in Full Tilt in 18 months. And I looked back at when I deposited the last time I deposited Full Tilt. And it had never come out of my account. Mm. So it was a legitimate charge from 18 months before. And I didn't think of anything at the time. But now that we learn that they basically didn't collect from a lot of people. And the reason why is because apparently the number is something like for every dollar that you put on the site, they would rake 40 cents. So they were taking 40% of the money that got on their site. So they were having trouble with their payment processors, the validity of it, the pace of it. So they would just allow deposits of virtual money onto the site so that they could rake it. Now, the thing that people don't discuss is, obviously, you know, they were giving themselves dividends, and they were basically stealing the money where the money wasn't segregated from players' accounts to their operating thing. But what about all the money that wasn't collected from people?
$130 million.
But not collected.
Not collected.
Right. So what are those? Did those people have a leg to stand on? They're the ones criticizing Full Tilt when they base... I wouldn't say that's necessarily stealing.
What if you don't know, though?
See, you and I differ on that. Like, I think most people
know. You didn't know for 18 months.
Yeah, but they definitely know now, though.
No, so. I understand, but, okay, let's say, for example, you took the $600 that you put on there 18 months ago.
Right.
You had no idea it didn't come out of your account. You're not really paying attention.
Right.
And you burn that, and you take that $600 and you turn it into $60,000. Okay? Do you have a leg to stand on?
But the thing is that most people, but I had only put on $600 and then I never thought about it. I think that a lot of people are going to look. Maybe they were looking at their finances, you know, under more scrutiny than me, saw that it didn't come out, and then continued to make these virtual deposits. I think that would be more prevalent than people that didn't do it.
I know. I know of one guy who plays pretty much every day here in St. Louis who was also playing online on Full Tilt, and when he deposited $1,000 and saw that it didn't come out of his account, he deposited another $1,000 and saw that it didn't come out of his account. And he kept doing that and kept doing that and kept doing that, and then he just withdrew the money. He never even played with it.
Because
they gave him money that they didn't have.
That's insane. Because for every guy that was like me that made one $600 deposit, lost it, and then didn't look at it, I think, you know, there might be like five guys like me and then one guy like your buddy. But that one guy like your buddy there, he's going to, you know, make 10 or 20 times worth the monetary deposit that I did, realizing that's going on.
There's also a matter of, think about it, if you know you can put $1,000 on or $2,000 on and it doesn't get taken out for a year, how easy is it to take that $2,000 and put it, go and jump into a high PLO game that you're not properly bankrolled for, but who cares?
Yeah.
Gamble ridiculously, and hey, if you happen to go on a hot streak, if you go on a heater and you can turn that into $26,000 really quick,
mm-hmm.
just withdraw it, yeah. And now you've just turned a fictional $2,000 into $26,000 that's real.
You literally free-rolled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, but you can easily do it because it's one of those spots where you go, well, you know what? If I lose it, who cares?
Right.
The money's not coming out, and then you can just object to it anyway in your bank.
Well, let me ask you this question. What was your buddy going to do?
First of all, he's not my buddy.
Excuse me. Yeah. What was this guy? Sorry about that. What was?
He's a poker player in St. Louis. I'm not going to say his name.
What was this guy going to do, though, like when they came to collect? Was he just going to say that it was an invalid charge?
Yeah.
Or he didn't have the money to cover it anyway.
Honestly, I never got to the conversation to that level. But I think eventually it was going to be, you know, like you get the Monopoly card, bank error, not in your favor. And now you got to give the money back. You know, it's like those stories about people who go to the ATM and they want to withdraw $20 and the machine gives them $200. They take the money, but then, you know, a couple of days later the bank goes, hey, you know what, you got too much and we're going to take that extra $180 out of your account. I think he was going to deal with it then, but I never got to that level of the conversation with him, so yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I think the real story, though, of this entire thing, though, is that if you look at the dividends that were paid and you look at the amount of money that was paid out and then the actual amount of money that's owed,
yeah,
there's a huge difference, like 270, is it 440 versus they paid themselves 150?
No, they paid themselves 440.
They paid themselves 440.
And they owed 390.
Oh, okay, and how much do they have? There's a big difference. I don't know what the number is,
yeah,
but I'm saying, is that difference enough where you think that the difference is from basically them putting virtual money on there and never collecting? That's where the difference comes from?
I think that the money that they were paying themselves with came from legitimate deposits from legitimate players,
right,
putting money into their regular accounts and them not segregating the money and saying, well, you know what, it's time for me to get my ownership percentage here. My dividend is due, and they paid themselves without saying, well, what if these players want their money back? And by the way, it's not our money in the first place. I think calling it a Ponzi scheme was a mistake, because it's not really a Ponzi scheme. There are no investors here being told you'll get X percent return, and you're paying off investors with other investors.
Ponzi scheme is just it's the new word of the last 5 or 6 years, obviously.
But this isn't Bernie Madoff.
No.
This, to me, is something completely different, but still horrible, which is you took money from people, telling them their money was safe and secure, and then giving it to yourselves. I mean, that to me, that's the bottom line there.
Did they ever actually claim that the money was in segregated accounts?
Yes.
They did. They actually made
public statements saying segregated, safe, and secure.
I mean, also in the same sense, I mean, I actually have friends that were affected by the Bernie Madoff scam. And you know, when you compare and you contrast the two, it's you look at the Bernie Madoff. When you invest, you know, generally speaking, you know, hey, there is some risk involved, mm-hmm, and you may lose your investment.
Mm-hmm.
But with Full Tilt, you know, when you put money on a poker site, you know when you play poker, you may lose.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, you're thinking that the Full Tilt brand or wherever you put your money, whether it's, you know, PokerStars or Full Tilt or any of these online sites, and I don't want to put PokerStars in even the same breath as I put Full Tilt.
Yeah.
That being said, it's you still consider it kind of a bank. And you're going, well, I'm not getting any interest on my money, but it's a bank and the money's safe there. Mm-hmm. I can leave it there. Okay.
The difference is, when you put it in a bank, you've got the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It's, yeah, FDIC insured. Mm-hmm. This wasn't even backed by the Alderney Gaming Council.
Mm.
You know, there wasn't any real regulation, which to me is the argument for why we need to license and regulate online poker in the United States so you don't have this sort of
thing. Well, you go back to that, that's the no-brainer. But, I mean, I guess my point being is, generally speaking, if you're investing in some Madoff type thing, you understand at least that you are taking some risk. Now, you don't think the risk is that he's stealing your money, but you think there is a market risk.
Yeah.
While when you put money on an online site, generally speaking, you're thinking, okay, the money should be safe there. Because I'm not actually investing.
Mm-hmm.
They're just holding my money.
Right.
The risk isn't that they're going to steal it.
Right.
Unfortunately, you know, hey, when the government doesn't get involved and, you know, the reason for the vast majority of laws and regulations is to actually protect the U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, at the end of the day, you look at it and go, okay, who's failed us more than anything? It's our government.
I just think this is just another amazing story in the stupidity of greed. You've got a business model where you're raking 40% of the total money that comes on. You're basically running a software program,
yep,
with very little expenses.
It's a license to print money.
And you still screw it up by overpaying yourself so that your model goes under. I mean, it might be worse than the whole Pot Ripper thing when they could see the cards and then the guy's folding pocket kings, pocket aces to his left when they could have continued fleecing people on UB for years,
yep,
if they had done it in a smart way.
This is the interesting thing. I spoke to my father about this because he called up. And before I want to go on, I do want to caution people saying, I know, I mean, I've worked with Full Tilt on shows. You know, I know nothing about the background.
As far as I know, you're the only person who's worked for Full Tilt and PokerStars.
Yeah. There are things I would say I am, but I can't say I'm on radio. No, but I mean, it's you know, I've done commentary for, you know, for a lot of different companies, and I did the Full Tilt $1 million cash game that was filmed out of London. And you know what? A lot of the guys that I know up high are really nice guys, and I've had drinks with them, and this really saddens me more than anything. I'm really sad by this. But going back to it, I will say, you know, my dad calls me up after this thing goes down. He wants to know what's going on. And I go, Dad, I gotta be honest, I don't really know. And he goes, but I don't understand. He goes, wasn't it just basically an ATM machine? Couldn't they just make money? I mean, it seems like a flawless business. And I'm like, well, except for the fact that they, you know, they couldn't operate out of the United States, and you know, and too many of their customers were U.S. based. I go, yeah, you know, it was.
Mm-hmm.
My dad just couldn't understand why and how it could be screwed up. And that's the only thing. I mean, a lot of people, when we talk about it on Live at the Bike, and you know, our third commentator asks us questions, or Bart and I talk about it, I always try to point out, I'm like, listen, I don't really know, you know, and I don't want to just be another blind voice added to the argument,
mm-hmm.
where I don't think we have the whole story yet.
Right.
And I'd like to, before I reserve judgment on anything, I'd like to hear the whole story and see what really happened. Hopefully we'll find out one day, and, you know.
Although I will say, though, that when the DOJ comes out and calls you a Ponzi scam or whatever thing you want to use, or when they come out and indict you, the DOJ usually doesn't lose. And, yeah, there's probably more to this story, but I think it's pretty condemning that they have come out and said that. Because when's the last time the DOJ has come after somebody and they've been flat wrong?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I find it objectionable that, you know, the DOJ would just come in and lump all of these sites together. It just seems from, like, their arguments, and it seems like they're somewhat ignorant of exactly what's going on.
Absolutely.
But
I think they have found out since then, by digging into this, the indictments have actually given them discovery, so they go in and find out, oh, we see what Full Tilt was doing, and then they go to PokerStars, and it's like, well, you guys weren't doing that. You guys were handling it right. I mean, I'm no shill for PokerStars in any way, but it's pretty obvious that up to this point, they operated in a completely upright and forthright way, as opposed to these other sites, which have given a bad name to online poker.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's terrible for all of us. You know, we never want poker. It's taken years and years to take poker out of the back alley.
Yes.
You know, and we're trying to give it, you know, some legitimacy, and things like this just kill it. You know, but I think a lot of people have this. You know, you watch CNBC and you see a 30-second report on poker, or online poker, and how it's defrauded people, and we suddenly lump everybody together. And that's not fair, because you look at a site like PokerStars, who, you know, days after Black Friday, they came out with an announcement. They did everything they possibly could to make an agreement and get their customers their money back right away.
Yep.
They did everything right. I don't want to go on this condemning, you know, a Full Tilt or anything like that, because, like I said, I don't know the full story.
Mm-hmm.
But while PokerStars has done everything right since April 15th, Full Tilt, well, hasn't.
Yeah.
I think the other thing, too, with Full Tilt is you've got to, at some point, you have to have some sort of PR, and you have to have some communication. Their communication has just been terrible.
No.
You can't not have communication almost 6 months after Black Friday. Keep putting out these little statements on 2+2, basically saying nothing. I mean, silence is, it's pretty, I think it just looks bad. Whatever the story is,
yeah,
like 5 months later, it's like, it's just.
The only announcement you've heard is, we might have an investor to buy. We might have an investor to buy. My dad was asking me, he's like, hey, I heard that maybe it's for sale. I'm going, at this point, what is it worth?
Right.
Who would buy it? I'm going, short of, like, you know, maybe a patent or two, or maybe some of the software.
Yep.
Short of that, I go, at this point, unfortunately, what's the name worth?
Why would someone buy a company that is in debt of, I guess, quite possibly $200-300 million and
with a damaged brand name like
that's
that?
That's what I mean. Yeah, I mean, yeah. If you were going to invest $250 million, my guess would be, hey, associate yourselves with somebody else, or just call it whatever. You can call it the poker site. I don't care what you call it, but right now that might be better than Full Tilt, unfortunately, for them.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. I'm Paul Harris here in St. Louis, while my partner Dennis Phillips is off in Europe. I'm talking with David Tuckman and Bart Hansen, the co-hosts of Live at the Bike, who also did some of the WSOP main event streams this summer online and on ESPN. When we come back, we're going to talk about a factor in live cash games that a lot of players don't think about, and that is the rake. But first, let's talk about what's coming up here at Harrah's St. Louis. Don't forget the tournament's going on 7 days a week. If you're a tournament player at the bottom end of the spectrum, or you want to get in on the $60 tournaments, they have 10 of those opportunities every week. And then they go up to $125 and $160, and sometimes once a month on the first Saturday of the month, they do the $310 tournament. Also, on the 22nd and 30th of October, your chance to play in the $200 buy-in, $10,000 double freeze-out event, where all you got to do is beat 9 people at the first table to make it to the final table, and then you win the final table, and you get a guaranteed $10,000. Also, at the end of this month, we'll be having our big cash game, $25.50 no limit with a $10 ante and a $15,000 minimum buy-in. We're already locking up seats for that game. If you want details on that, you can email DennisPhillipsPoker@gmail.com. And if you want to find out about the tournament schedule or anything else here at Harrah's St. Louis, you can call the Poker Room at 314-770-7600 or go to their website, harrahs.com/STLPoker. Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, the home of the Final Table Poker Radio Show, every Tuesday at 3, live on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. You can also get our podcast for free via iTunes or listen to them on thechipleader.com.
Kids, are you caught up in that old game of shuffling your debt around and hoping you'll get lucky and win the jackpot? Well, it's time to deal. Mortgage rates are low and savings are high. So stop bluffing and call 800-GRANNY-8 or go to granny8.com. You bet our friendly loan officers make it easy, and we don't have an application fee. So call 800-GRANNY-8 and you'll be holding all the aces.
Great mortgage rates, call 800-GRANNY-8.
granny8.com.
This is a special edition of the Final Table Poker Radio Show, brought to you by Harrah's St. Louis and in part by Homestead Financial Mortgage. For great mortgage rates, call 800-GRANNY-8. Now more of my conversation with Dave Tuckman and Bart Hansen, the two co-hosts of Live at the Bike, who also did some of the online commentary this summer for ESPN for the World Series of Poker main event.
While we're talking about online poker, let's talk about American players who have moved to Costa Rica or Mexico or Canada. Do you guys know guys who've made that move, and how's it working out for them?
I know a few, and it's interesting. My dad actually plays cards in New York with Scott Seaver's grandfather. And as a result, you know, I've become friendly with Scott. And it's funny, a lot of Scott's friends have actually moved, and they've chosen Italy, of all places.
Pasta lovers.
Yeah. but the strange thing is that Italy actually has a closed, you can only play in country.
Right. PokerStars has Italy, and they have one in France.
In France now.
Estonia and a couple of others. And I think Party Poker does.
And
well,
I would have thought that maybe they would have chosen a different European country where it's not a closed
right.
a closed plus play. But, I mean, I've been to San Remo, and I've been to Italy for a while, and I've played against a lot of Italians. And, hey, anything if anybody's played against Italians, you probably are not surprised that they moved to Italy to play poker. Because it's actually games. But, yeah, a lot of people have moved to Canada now. Or, you know, they'll rent an apartment in Vancouver or Toronto, and they'll live there 6 months a year. So they'll go up there for, like, the W Coupe or the Scoop or any of the major online tournaments they want to go.
Right.
It just goes to show you that it is a little bit of a different skill set. I mean, poker is poker. But I think some guys that are pros live wouldn't necessarily want to play online full-time. They would want to shoot themselves and vice versa. Some of these guys online do not want to play live just because of the pace of the game.
Yeah, the other side of it, just Greg Mueller, actually, who we're both friends with. I played hockey with him a little while ago, and he's a great guy. He actually says when he's in Vancouver, he doesn't play hockey. He doesn't play poker at all. He's just hanging out. He's hanging out with his friends. He's going to see ball games. He's going to see hockey games. He's working out. And then what he does is kind of the opposite of what these online players is. He comes to Vegas or he comes to Los Angeles or wherever he might play, and he puts in, you know, hours after hours. I mean, he puts in these 12-hour days, and he plays, you know, 6 days a week, and it's all poker for 3 or 4 weeks straight. And then he goes away, and he doesn't play for a month or so. And my guess would be that a lot of these online guys will do the same thing, where, you know, they might go to Europe for 4 months, or they might go to Canada for 4 months, and just really kind of push themselves.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Paul Harrah's talking with David Tuckman and Bart Hansen, the co-host of Live at the Bike. Bart also does the strategy podcast called Deuce Plays. While we're talking about online players, talk to me about online players who had to move to live-only play, the ones who are still here in the United States. Have you seen an influx of them into the live games? And, A, how have they changed their game to play live? And have they? And, B, how has it changed the game for the other players at the table?
Well, honestly, there isn't as much of an influx as you would think. Literally in the 5-10 game, I haven't seen many what you would call online players come in at all. And the ones that are young, just because a guy's young doesn't mean that they're good. I've seen a couple of young guys that say they're online players come in, and they're not that good. Maybe they were sit-and-go grinders
or something
like
that. It's funny
you
said, you know, 10 years ago it used to be, well, just because he's young doesn't mean he's bad.
Yeah.
That's the opposite.
There have been a few players up in the upper section playing 10-20 no limit and the PLO games that are really good players that you know come from online. Like I said, it is the same skill set, but it really hasn't changed as much as you would think. There hasn't been this crazy influx that has made the games tougher. If you're a good online player, you should definitely be able to beat the games live, unless you've got some sort of, you know, crazy leak where you're not patient enough, or, you know, you're doing... But usually it takes a little bit of adjustment time, and then those guys are good players. I just haven't seen it. And I played the casino where there's 6 or 7 5-10 games going on. There might be... I always say that the amount of people that play in the 5-10 at Commerce more than twice a month, there's probably 1,000 people. Literally, there's 1,000 people in the player pool. There might be 5 new kids that have come in.
That's all.
I mean, on a regular basis, yeah. It just hasn't happened.
Wow.
Yeah, once in a while on Live at the Bike, we'll spread like a 25, 50, or a 10, 25 no limit game, and we'll see a player you can tell was playing online a lot. The one thing that I do think, and sometimes actually you and I talk about this, Bart and I talk about one of like Bart's leaks. And I think sometimes online players have this as well when they come to a game where they almost out-level themselves. They give their opponent way too much credit. They go, well, he's going to put me on this range of hands. So based on that and from where I played and how big my stack is, there's no way he could play it this way. And I'm going, that guy is it. Look at him. He's 70 years old. He's got paint on his face. He's not thinking about anything except the fact that, you know, he's got dirt under his fingernails. He's wondering where he's getting his next beer, and he doesn't know what to do when he's got top pair and a jack kicker.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know anything about anything. So it's like sometimes I think the online players, and I think a lot of good players also, I think sometimes they out-level themselves, and they kind of give their opponent too much credit, and, you know.
Or sometimes not enough credit. How could he have a 6? What 6 could he possibly have here in this situation? How could it, you know?
Yeah. They don't really, I mean, one of the biggest things, too, is they don't realize the tightness of their opponent's range. And, you know, spots online where they would get it in pre-flop or whatever on the flop in a 100 BB online game, they're not the same type of spots if you're playing against, like, an old Nick. You know, ace-king versus a guy that just limp re-raised you is not a shove-all-in for 200 BBs like I've seen some guys do. Ace-king suited in a cash game. And it's just terrible. And I see guys online that live or die by ace-king. You also see tournament players. Ace-king is just not a powerhouse hand in a cash game when you're playing deep. It's not like a tournament, and it doesn't do well against a live, quote-unquote, nits three-betting range.
I'm not even going to say a live – forget about live nits. How about the vast majority of live players, their four-betting range consists of aces and kings.
Mm-hmm.
Their four-betting range is aces, kings, occasionally queens. You know, and you'll see players, you'll see, you know, somebody like, you know, overplay – get 155 big blinds in with ace-king, which is never right against a live player.
Not only that, you have some of these players whose 3-bet range is that, and yet you'll see somebody in the big blind look down at ace-king and think, well, here's my opportunity to 4-bet and really play a hand against this guy. Out of position. Overplaying ace-king is a topic we've touched on so many times on this show.
Mark.
It's unbelievable how many people get carried away with ace-king in their hand.
Well, I was also telling Dave, one of the things that's changed in the last, say, 12 to 18 months is even the really weak players that you would love to have in your game, and we know a couple of them that go down on the bike and stuff, they're still bad post-flop, but they've tightened up a lot. And I think sometimes it's a little bit of a leak in my game, and a lot of online players do it transitioning from online to live, is that they're 3-betting a lot. And the whole reason why 3-betting became prevalent online was because people were opening light. They would realize that they don't need a hand to open. So therefore, you can re-raise a guy because, you know, if he's folding 70% of the time, you show an immediate profit. The problem now, though, is that if you take that and you're like, I'm going to throw in some 3-bet bluffs against guys that don't really open light, even if you're in position, you're at a big disadvantage going in preflop.
Yeah.
Because a guy is going to have ace-king. He's going to have queens. And you're 3-betting with king-3 suited. He's not folding when he still has an overpair on the flop. So you're basically just burning off money.
Yep.
The crazy thing, we did the webcast for the Legends of Poker main event, the World Poker Tour event, back in August. And it was unprecedented. We did from day one all the way to the final 6.
Wow.
And it was great. I mean, we literally had day one coverage. And to me, that was really exciting because we saw each player start with 30,000 chips and how you actually played your stack on level one.
Mm-hmm.
We saw so many 4-bet, 5-bet bluffs to the point where I want to say we saw maybe 34 bets over the six-day span, and 20 of them were actually bluffs.
I think it was even more. I think it was more like 5% were for, I mean, 5 were for value, 25 were bluffs.
Right. The point, though, basically being, is, and Bart and I were talking about this, going, well, if a guy is four-betting, if his four bets are bluffs 66% of the time, well, then you can profitably bluff five bets. You know, you can five-bet bluff, which kind of goes back to the whole Max Heinzelman, back to the big Max Heinzelman, Sean Deeb hand over the summer, when Heinzelman got it in with ace-six against Deeb's aces.
Right.
And everybody's home going, what a donk. Well, if you watch this, you can see and go, okay, these guys are four-betting, five-betting, even six-bet bluffing. But if you take that, or if, even if you do that online in cash games, and you think that's what's happening in live poker, live cash games, you are sorely mistaken.
Right. And also in those tournaments, though, guys, I mean, a deep stack is going to be 60, 70 big blinds. Online, where you see that those crazy pre-flop, those are usually in 100 big blind games. That dynamic does not exist. It just doesn't exist in a cash game when the stacks are deeper. So, you know, guys are never 4-bet. It's not like, oh, you're going to see a 25 times out of 30, it's a 4-bet bluff. No, in a live cash game, 25 times out of 25 times, it's going to be, you know, aces or kings.
Yeah.
It's the exact opposite. So, you know, you have to make that adjustment.
I want to talk to you about another strategy point. I don't think Dennis and I have talked about this for about 2 years on this show, and it is the effective rake on players at a live cash game. I've joked that if you come in and you play in a 3-6 limit game and you have 10 people sit down with $100, an hour later you'll have 10 people with $90 and nobody will know what happened to the rest of the money. The casino has gotten that, and that's how casino poker rooms make their money, is by dropping $4 at a time at every hand, and that's what pays the dealers, that's what pays for the lights and the shufflers and the supervisors and all the... That's how a casino poker... It's the only way that a casino poker room makes money. But if you're a player, you have to be aware of the effect of that rake on your game. And if you play a lot, you got to be aware of how much you're putting in on an annual basis that you have to overcome. Talk a little bit about that from your perspective as a strategy guy.
Well, I mean, I can give you even a better example than that. The $100 cap... There's some really weird games in LA, these restricted buy-in games... Games that you don't really see in Vegas or anywhere else where they're really restricted. Like a $2, $3 blind, $100 cap game. Or a $2, $5, $200 cap game.
Or a $5, $10, $400
cap
game.
Yeah, that's a little bit weird too. The example I want to give you is the $100 cap game. So it's 2-3 blinds, it's $100. The rake is, in LA, it's a straight rake. It's straight drop. It's not a rake, so you're not taking a percentage. Once you see a flop, they take the full rake. It's $4 plus $1 for the bad beat jackpot. So every hand they're taking $5. If you play conservatively 30 hands an hour, and you probably do more than that and hold them, they are taking $150 an hour from the table. You've got nine players with $100 stacks. That's only $900. So in 6 hours, the money has been entirely raked off the table,
mm-hmm.
which is why really you cannot beat low-level poker, especially with the structure of the drop in California. In Vegas, it might be slightly different because they take a rake. They take a percentage up to a certain amount.
Yep.
But for
as they do here in St. Louis, and we actually have one of the lowest rakes in the country at just $4 plus the dollar bad beat.
Yeah, you know, for the most part, I think the very first level that you can start playing professionally is usually going to be a $5 blind no limit game, $5 big blind no limit game, and you're going to be squeaking out a living. Because the problem is if you're playing 2-5 no limit with a $5 or $6 rake, you might be able to live off of it, but you're not really be able to save money as a bankroll. Like, if you're making $30 an hour, it's going to be really difficult if you're doing that full time to save money as a bankroll. I get emails in all the time about this part. You know, I'm trying to play $200 cap and build my bankroll up, and I'm like, you know, how can you do that, you know, with living? Really, the first, I even think that 5-10 is basically the first actual level where you're like, okay, I can do this. I can save money. I can make a decent living. You know, you can play 5-5 in LA where you might be able to make $50-$60 an hour, which, you know, is a good living too. But the rake is a huge, huge consideration. And as the players become less and less losers, like I talked about in the beginning of the show, when you're playing against tougher opponents that are closer to break even, it's more difficult to overcome the rake.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you talk about, and it's a good point. I think if you are aspiring professional poker player and you don't have another job, it's going to be very, very difficult at the low levels. And the reason being is because you can't build a bankroll. So when, you know, when variance does strike and you go on that inevitable downturn, you know, you don't have the savings or the bankroll to kind of withstand that. And I think that's something you have to be aware of, especially if you're a poker player. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with playing small limits if you have another job, because you can beat the game, just not at a livable, sustainable level,
right?
Because of, you know, the eventual downturn. But if you have a day job, if you're working 40 hours a week or 30 hours a week, and you have a job where you're making a decent living and you can survive off that, and then you play, say, 15 hours a week on the side, and you can make, hey, if you could make $12 an hour doing that, well, hey, $12 an hour times, you know, 10, 12 hours a week, you know, it'll be difficult to, you know, build a bankroll or live on that. But if you're living on your side job, then you can put that money away.
Right.
And then maybe after 6 months or after a year, you can look in your little poker bankroll and you can go, oh, wow, I actually have some money here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something you have to be aware of. I think, you know, one thing that's been coming up big in Los Angeles is a lot of home games. And, you know, Bart and I were talking about that because Bart kind of got involved in the home games a little bit. But those games are virtually unbeatable.
Yeah.
Because of the rake.
The lineup has to be so good because the rake is ridiculous.
I was going to say, like, that's actually the – I was going to give that example as the flip side of the lower-level games. Normally, when you talk about playing 50, 100, no limit, you don't usually have rake considerations because in a place like Bellagio or any place else, the rake is actually the same as, like, in a 5-10 game. They're taking $5 a hand or they're doing a time collection. So the bigger that you play, it's the less rake considerations. But a great example of how rake considerations or you have to, you know, launch the rake considerations are those home games. And that's something that's not really discussed a lot in LA casinos because people don't want to discuss it. But the home games have been going on for 3-4 years and they have literally bled the city dry. It actually ruined, I think, a lot of big no-limit games in LA because these proprietors took these action guys that were going to lose anyways, the really bad fish in the casinos, and they brought them into an environment that's really nice in a house with girls and, you know, free alcohol and gourmet food into a softer game. But the problem was that instead of now taking $10 per half hour like they do at Commerce, they're taking $50, $100 per hand. In a 10-25 game or a 25-50 game with really deep stacks, and the dealers are sometimes stealing money out. They would literally rake – they might rake $15,000 over the course of 10 hours in a 10-25 game or a 25-50 game. But these guys who are losing anyways don't realize it, and now they've basically take the proprietors gotten the money from everyone, and now finally the games have really slowed. Like, whereas you might have had 25 home games a night, some nights, now there's really like only one, two, or three around the whole city.
I think the lesson is for poker players and for us and for anybody who's listening to us, is that pay attention to what's being taken out of the pot. I said that I did the European poker tour and I would go around. And when I was in San Remo, I was excited because everybody said the cash games were really good. So I went and checked it out during my free time. And I found that they go, what's the rake? Because that's what, if you're a professional poker player, that's the question you have to ask. What is the rake? What are you taking out? You know, I have no problem with you taking money. I see this beautiful casino. I know you've got to build it somehow.
Yep.
You know, in San Remo, they take 10% out. And I go, okay, so what's the cap? And they go, oh, the cap's 50 euros. 50 euros? And I'm giving you this look, which isn't working on radio.
I'm stunned. I couldn't say anything.
Was that in a 5-10 euro game?
No, it was in a 10-20 euro game. It was at a 10-20 euro game where the min buy-in was like 400 euros.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of odds are buying in short anyway. But every pot was 500 euros.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost every single pot was that big. And they were taking out 50 euros a hand. And I'm going, and everybody's like, yeah, but the game is really good. And I'm like, how good can the game be that's going to justify a 50 euro? I'm going, okay, let's say on average I win what? Let's say I win 3 hands an hour. I'm like, I'm paying 150 euros an hour in that game.
Right.
I'm going, how much do I have to beat that game by for it to be worthwhile?
Yeah. And by the way, if you do, you can't do it long-term enough to overcome what the rake is going to do to you long-term.
Well, you start thinking about it. And it actually, the same way it might adjust your thinking, I don't know if you've ever played, I'm sure you have, in a rake pot game.
Mm-hmm.
Where and just for our listeners who don't know, it's, you know, most often, you know, you play in a casino and they take money out every hand. Some casinos will do it every half hour. Now, sometimes in the bigger games, when they do it every half hour, what the players decide to do instead of actually taking it out, they'll do a pot rake, where it's like basically
time
a time collection.
Time pot.
Basically, yeah. Whoever wins that pot will pay collection for the entire
table. It has
to
be over a certain amount.
Exactly.
And, you know, if it's going to be $8 per person and there's nine people there, $72 is going to come out of the first pot over $500
exactly.
or whatever.
Exactly. And the winner has to pay. Well, that affects your strategic decisions during that hand,
mm-hmm.
Knowing that, okay, if I win this particular pot, I will have to pay $72. That affects your—and it should affect your decisions.
Yep.
You know, long-term, that will affect your bankroll and, you know, your expected value. And the same way, I think if you're sitting down in a casino, be aware of what they're taking.
And by the way, when he was saying 10% with a $50 cap, a lot of the home games in L.A. was 10% uncapped.
Uncapped.
So, yeah, so I'll give you an example of that. Now, the funny thing is, I've actually talked to some poker players that have – some guys play in these home games where they get, like, a rake-back deal. They'll get paid $500 a night to play in the game to help start it. There actually is a strategy to play in those games, and I just don't like it because I don't think it's really poker. And you're basically what's called, like, best-handing everyone, where you just sit there, you don't play poker, and you – try to play like aces or kings, and occasionally you try to get in there and set mine. But you can't win pots. If you start winning a lot of pots, you're going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys who are getting the rake back deal, they're almost playing the game to break even and get a slight win. And the way to do that is to stay out of as many pots as possible. Because once, like if you, like in 5-10, like I'm winning tons of pots and I pay a bunch of rake at Commerce, where if I might be winning 4 or 5 pots an hour. Now, if you're winning 4 or 5 pots an hour, you're paying €50 per hour, then there's no way you're ever going to win.
Let me ask you this, Barton. I throw it to both of you guys. If you're playing in a time collection game, or if you're playing in a game that's raked per hand, does that affect the way you play ever? I mean, I know there are certain things we always say. A poker's about adapting and adjusting. Okay, I adapt and adjust to my opponents. If I'm playing in a really, really laggy game with a bunch of online guys, you know, I'm going to play differently than if I'm going to play with, you know, 5 guys that are over 50 who are just sitting there waiting for the nuts.
As a guy over 50, I appreciate that. Please play differently against me.
No, you know what I'm saying? I'm going to play differently against everybody.
I understand.
You know, whether
it's Bard.
I know. It's just a matter of, like, you know, if a guy is sitting there waiting for the nuts, hey, at the same time, it won't take me very long to figure out, okay, Paul's over 50, but you know what? He's not waiting for the nuts.
Mm-hmm.
He can play.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, though, would your game adjust, and should your game change, knowing that, okay, if I win 9 hands this hour, 10 hands this hour, it's time collection, and that's no problem. But if I win 10 hands this hour, it's actually going to cost me $50 because that's the rake. Should I? I mean, would you ever tighten up in a game that's raked per hand, and maybe loosen up in a more in a game that was time collection?
Well, yeah. I mean, the example is at 10-20 at Commerce, you pay $10 per half hour, but in 5-10. You pay $6 per every hand you win. And I'll give you an example because it's something I just discovered in the last 6 months. If you're playing in a raked game, and this is especially true for the lower levels, but even in 5-10, I found myself making a mistake that it took me years to actually figure out is, say a guy limps in, and you'll see this a lot, a guy open limps, and now you're on the button with a hand like, say, 6-7 suited or 5-6 suited. It is really a mistake there to over-limp. It's a very playable hand. You're like, well, it's no limit. The stacks are deep. That's a spot where you should either raise or fold, because if you limp in there and then the blinds check, you have to pay the entire rake. The pot's not big enough to justify you basically limping in for 10 and them taking basically what is 20% of the pot.
Mm.
You actually have to juice the pot up pre-flop. So if you are, I guess to the listeners out there, if you were thinking of over-limping one or two people with like an implied odds type of hand in a raked game, it's probably a losing proposition specifically.
Well,
there's
also the added benefit of if you're one limper folds, you're only paying, because I know at the bicycle casino,
If you raise
and everybody folds,
yeah.
You can actually take it down without a flop, and I think it's only like a $1 rake then instead of $6. So you're actually saving $5.
It's a modified rake.
But
right.
I throw that out to you. Should you change your strategy based on how much rake is being taken out, whether it's a time collection game or... And at the same time, hey, if you think your opponents might be changing their strategy because of that as well.
Well, guys that have emailed me in, because I, you know, like I told you, I said I think a $100 game is unbeatable. I've had a couple guys email me and they said, hey, I've played 500-600 hours in a $100 cap game. My hourly is like $15 an hour. This is how I do it. And they all say that they play... It's exactly the same strategies I would say to play in those super high home games. They just don't play any pots. you cannot afford to play. You're basically sitting there folding and best handing people preflop and getting in there like with multi-way action and set money.
Well, it goes back to what we were saying earlier. I mean, the guy playing the $100, you can make money playing in low. You can play money. You can make money in those games.
Mm-hmm.
And while $15 an hour is fine money, it's good money, it's really hard to live off that and build a bankroll.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only thing we were cautioning people before. It's like, okay, well, if you have a side job, great. But if you don't, and you're expecting to build a bankroll and live off $15, hey,
right,
I want to know where you're living.
Yeah. But just to put this in monetary terms, if you play 1-2 or 1-2-5, which we have here at Harris, 1-2-5 no limit game, and you win, let's say you play 40 hours a week, and you win one hand per hour, you're going to be putting in more than $10,000 into the rake in the course of a year. One hand an hour, 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year, that's $2,000. You're putting in $5 between the bad beat and the $4 rake, plus you're tipping the dealer, which makes it $6. So now you're putting in $12,000 that you didn't get. You have to overcome that $12,000 that you gave to the house. And by the way, no complaint about giving it to the house. We like having good poker rooms to play in with professional dealers and nice environments, and especially here, smoke-free, glassed-in, etc. All that we're willing to pay for. But if you're a player, you have to understand that that is something you have to overcome in order to make any kind of living at it. Now, if you're just a recreational player, and you're coming in to have a couple of beers, and you bring a couple of $100 in, and you're just going to come and have a good time and play, then that's not a consideration of how you play at all.
But, you know, you should be aware, though, if you're sitting down at a 1-2 game, and let's say, even if you're playing for fun, mm-hmm. you go to Vegas, you come to St. Louis, you want to play at Harris, you want to play it anywhere, and you let's say you play for 10 hours, and you're like, wow, I had so much fun. And you look down, and you're like, oh, I only won $31. You should actually realize that you probably had a great night, because you probably won more like $150, yet you gave back $120.
Yeah.
You know, between tipping the waitress and tipping the dealer and the rakes, you probably had a pretty good night. Mm-hmm. So you shouldn't beat yourself up about that.
Yeah.
No, you're not going to make a living on that. But if you're a recreational player, you should actually probably should pat yourself on the back and realize that, okay, it wasn't just like, you know, it wasn't just like kissing my sister.
Yep.
I did okay.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of rake that I've paid over time, you know, over my, like you were just saying, like in 5-10, I'm playing, you know, $6 a hand. I'm probably, let's say I'm paying about $25 an hour, which is about, because I do win a lot of pots, you know, maybe 4 out of 35. $25 an hour, if I'm playing 40 hours a week, that's $1,000 a week. I mean, I'm easily paying $40,000.
By the way, this
is,
I have to deal with this on a daily basis.
A year.
Listen to Bart so pompous. I win a lot of pots. I'm Bart Hansen. I win a lot of pots.
But even if you do it in a time collection game at 10-20, if you play 40 hours a week, it costs you $20 per hour. So it's the same thing. It's $40,000 over the course of the year. That's why actually break-even players, if you take away the rake, are actually winning players. But the rake is a huge consideration. People are like, well, it's only a couple dollars a hand. No, it turns probably a player pool of maybe 20% of the people could beat the game without the rake down to, with the rake, like maybe 2%, if not less, especially at the lower levels. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's a very big consideration.
Well, it also, you know, it's funny. Both Bart and I, we met originally when we were both propping at the Bicycle Casino.
Mm-hmm. Explain what propping is.
Okay, I started propping in January of 04, and propping basically is where the casino pays you to play. But they're not paying you. You have to play with your own money, and you're at risk, but they are paying you an hourly wage. Generally, they're also giving you your rake back. And the downside is everybody goes, oh, wow, how do I sign up for that? Well, the downside is you have to play the games they want you to play. And generally speaking, the rule of thumb is if the game is good, you're not in it. Mm. If the game is bad, you're in it. Because
mm-hmm.
they don't need you in full games. They need you in games that are just starting, in games to keep them going. Anyway, so I started propping back in 04, and I was a limit prop. No limit wasn't as, not really around as much. Bart started a little bit later, and we became friends that way. But a lot of people have asked me, why would a casino pay you to play? Well, when you start hearing the numbers that Bart just rallied off, like, hey, I probably paid $40,000 in rake this year, you realize how much money the casinos are making. And, hey, they do their job. It's a great casino. I'm glad they have them. Having said that, though, you look and go, well, this is how much money they're making. So to have a game go, it makes sense for them to have pay 5 or 6 or 7 props to keep these games going, especially in the lean hours, you know, middle of day type things. But yeah, that's where, you know, Bart and I both got our start propping. We were both limit props. We played, you know, we played 08, we played stud high low, we played limit hold'em, and then we dabble in no limit. And then it was really in it was really in 05 where both of us kind of no limit kind of opened our eyes. We were like, wait a second, I can make so much more in this game. And then we went over there. But yeah, I mean, I think rake is definitely a consideration. I mean, I think like anything in poker, you know, if you're going to be a poker player, protect yourself. You know, against angle shooters, against too much rake, know what's going on in the game.
Right.
You know, be aware.
Yeah, very important factor. Guys, before we go, let's get some plugs in. Bart, you've got the Deuce Plays podcast, which you just turned into a subscription podcast through Deuces Cracked.
That's right, and actually that has, by this time, it's come out. But yeah, you can head over to deucescracked.com, and or you can Google Deuce Plays, and it comes out. I've had people say, well, why are you making it subscription? Why are you making it subscription? I was actually thinking about doing this before Black Friday. I mean, my strategy podcast is specifically about live poker, and I think that there's a pretty big market niche for that now that you can only play live.
Right.
I've got 3.5 years of a back catalog of free podcasts. I've done 171-hour podcasts. Now I think it's time to actually move it more over to a segmented training type of podcast, which it actually has been for the last year. But if you know, if you want to improve your live no limit game, I don't think there's a better tool.
By the way, 3 out of 4 of his listeners are there for poker. The fourth person is using it as a sleep aid.
I have
your friend right here.
When I can't sleep, I drove to Vegas with my girlfriend, and I put Bart's podcast on.
I do have a soothing voice.
And sure enough, I'm listening to the poker, and my girlfriend fell asleep, and she was like, it was perfect. Well, come on, let's be honest. You're going to listen to somebody drone on about poker for 45 minutes? You're either going to be entranced, or you're going to be sleeping.
Yeah. Well, as a person who does a poker show and a poker podcast, I'm hoping our listeners are entranced.
There you go.
That's why we bring in guests like you.
And there's another thing, too, that I'm doing, which is live, you know, like a training videos, like a Card Runners, like Deuces Cracked, over live poker.
Crush it, live poker.
It's live poker, and it's not over a hand replayer. It's over a live at the bike game. So it's basically training videos over live poker. I'm pretty much the only person in the world that's got access, the ability to do that. And, yeah, that's called Crush Live Poker, so you can check that out at crushlivepoker.com. I did a series of live poker training videos for Deuces Cracked. This is just an extension of that. And, yeah, so it's, you know, it's all – and, again, you know, if you want to increase your no-limit win rate, I think that's – it's a really good tool.
Cool. Yeah. And, Dave, what do you have?
I'm not going to plug. I mean, I'd say watch us on Live at the Bike. It's a great show. It really – it's a lot of fun.
When does it air? And is it
Live at the Bike is on Tuesdays and Friday nights right now. 7:30 Pacific time until about 10:30 Pacific time. The nice thing about it is it's interactive. Since we are only on a 10-15 minute delay, we respond to tweets. Bart Hansen is Bart Hansen. I'm Tuck on Sports. So watch Live at the Bike. You know, coming up for me, I'll be in the UK covering NFL. I also cover NFL. I cover NASCAR as well as poker.
How is the NFL in Britain?
That's great. It's great. Well, we've got tons of, you know, you got tons of, you know, expatriates over there. You've got, you know, Americans, you've got Canadians over there that love the sport. There's also, there was, you know, NFL Europe that kind of brought up the sport a lot. And, you know, the ratings are actually really good.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of fun doing it. Yeah, I'm going to be covering week 7 and 8.
You do the play-by-play on Sky?
I'm either the lead host, like I'm kind of the James Brown when they come back to the studio, or I'm actually an analyst as well.
Oh.
And I'll be covering week 16 and 17 there as well, and hopefully some playoffs. So it'll be a lot of fun. So I'm doing that. Obviously, the November 9, I'm looking forward to, which would be a ton of fun. But
what's the lineup for that? I mean, is it going to be just like when you guys did the main event this summer? You're going to do the same thing? Or
I assume. I haven't heard yet. You know, I think ESPN and a poker productions team, great, one of the best production teams I've ever worked with. They're fantastic.
Yeah. Maury
you know,
and his crew are unbelievable.
Dan and Maury are great, and the whole group. My guess is they'll be talking to ESPN, figure out what worked, what didn't work, how can we get better, how can we improve. And, you know, we'll take all of that and we'll look at what we did over the summer and hopefully make it even better for November 9. And, you know, going forward, make it even better than that.
Well, the plan there is probably going to be just streaming. They're not going to do an ESPN 2 live thing a few nights before they do the edited version on regular ESPN, are they?
Yeah, I don't know. Because it's clearly, I mean, from what I've watched and from what I've heard from fans, it's completely different. It's a completely different animal.
It is.
It's, and I think it caters to In some ways, the same audience, but in a lot of times, it's completely a different audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my girlfriend, you know, unless she turns it into a drinking game, you know, and watch, she's not watching the live poker.
Yeah. Is that because the pace of live poker is so much slower than edited poker?
Yeah, and I think, yeah, I mean, I think part of that is that. I think it's also a matter of, she might turn it up for 45 minutes, but she's not going to watch 6 hours of it.
Yeah.
You know, but there are a lot of people that love that and love to see every single hand and want to see the entire story. And, you know, they want to see who's bluffing who and how a play was set up 3 hours earlier. So it's yet to be determined exactly what we're going to do.
I actually hadn't even thought of that, because the last couple of years they've done – they did the final table on Sunday, and it was – they call it like an Olympic speed edit, and then they put on the show on Tuesday.
Right.
So to put it on ESPN2 with Gold Cards on Sunday and then do the TV show on Tuesday.
I mean, something you guys are both kind of guessing at it. I don't know. You'd think I would. But I honestly do not know what they're going to do. And I'm sure, you know, like I said, I mean, we've got, some really smart people at ESPN working on this. And we've got Dan and Maury working on it with the rest of the Poker Productions crew working on it.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll come up with something that's, you know, that's great.
Whatever it is, I'm glad you're going to be a part of it, because I think you added a lot this summer.
Thanks. I really do appreciate it. It was a lot of fun. It was, you know, it was a dream come true. Like I said, I mean, whether it's the NFL or not, I mean, the World Series is the pinnacle of our craft and our sport.
Yep.
And I remember I got the phone call from ESPN and I got the phone call from Maury, and I was just, I was over the moon, you know, I was so excited. But Live at the Bike is really, to me, that's where, hey, if you want to be, you know, you want to talk to us about poker, you want to talk to us about strategy, you know, that's, we're giving it away. It's free.
Mm-hmm.
And you can watch and you can tweet us questions, and it's fun. And it's, by the way, I mean, nothing is off limits, you know. We are rude, we're crude, we're unedited, we go where we shouldn't go. I mean, every other show I'm getting a little bit of tidbit, like, Dave, pull it back a little bit, pull it back. But that's what we do on the show. It's a lot of fun. So
cool.
Every Tuesday, every Friday night.
That's David Tuckman and Bart Hansen, my guests on a special edition of the Final Table Poker Radio Show. I'm Paul Harris here in St. Louis, off to Hammond, Indiana, for the World Series of Poker Circuit event that starts there later this week. I'll report on that next week, and by then, Dennis will be back from the World Series of Poker Europe to talk about that adventure. Join us Tuesday at 3, live on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com from the Harris St. Louis Poker Room, or get our podcast on demand anytime via iTunes or on thechipleader.com.